The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, I would like to talk about how to engage in the Dharma, how to engage in Buddhist practice. And there is a traditional teaching that there are three major activities that a person can be involved in when they engage in the Dharma. And one is they can learn the Dharma, they can study it. The second is they can reflect on it. And the third is they can practice it. And that those three all work together. They're mutually supportive and beneficial. So the studying it, traditionally the word is listening to it, because in the time of the Buddha there were no books. The only way to learn about it was by listening to someone who had memorized the teachings or were teaching it. And so here today you guys are listening to me, so that's certainly part of it. But then also it's for you to reflect on what's being said. It's, either during a talk or afterwards as you go home, is to engage the material. Don't just take it as a given, so that's good, but to question it, to explore it, to contemplate what it all means for you in your life. And that's a very important part of the Dharma practice. And the third is to practice it. And practice is something different than contemplating it and thinking about it. And practice has a lot to do with entering into our direct, immediate experience, making direct contact with what's happening here. And I think it's best to have all three, like a tripod that's stable with three legs. And if you don't have all three, it's easy to become kind of wobbly. And what I'd like to do is to talk about these three in a way that kind of builds from the talk last week. Last week's talk was mindfulness of thinking, the world of thinking. And so it might be interesting to kind of continue with that theme a little bit for another week. So in hearing the Dharma, you might hear a variety of things about thinking, like you did last week. And you might learn, the Dharma teaches that it's very important to be mindful of thinking, to understand what goes on when we think, and to question not only what we think, but even question the whole process of thinking. What is thinking itself? And many people can be engaged with their thinking by thinking more about it, but very few people actually take that kind of backward step, or that get an overview step, and actually observe the phenomena of thinking itself. And so we're told to look at thinking, explore it. That's part of the Dharma teaching. One of the things we teach is that our thinking can also interfere with our direct experience. It can interfere with us living our life more fully and directly. And so if we want to live fully or directly, it's very important to shift how we think or our relationship to thinking so thinking doesn't interfere. So there's inhibition, there's beliefs, there's fears that come through thinking. We can think so much we don't see what's actually happening in front of us. And we don't hear what's going on because we're lost in our thoughts. And that interferes. But also it can interfere with ourselves, because we can be talking so much to ourselves in our head, or being so caught up in images, that we don't really know what's going on with us in a deeper way. We might think we do, because we think that thinking is who we are. But there's much deeper, I'd say deeper aspects of who we are that we can be cut off from if we're only negotiating our world through the avenue of thinking about it, thinking about ourselves. So, and then Buddhism teaches that how we relate to our thoughts and ideas is a very important source for our suffering. And if we want to do is to become free of suffering, we have to at least understand, look at, how are we relating to a thought that arises? a belief that arises, an idea that arises, an interpretation that arises, a commentary, a judgment we have for what's going on. How do we relate to the models of our reality, models of ourselves that our mind produces? The mind is a model-making machine. It creates representations. And so we have representation for ourselves, for people outside of us, for the world. And how do we relate to that? How do we hold that? If we hold it one particular way, we'll suffer. If we hold a different way, we won't. If we hold it with clinging and resistance, more likely you're going to suffer. If you hold it very lightly, with open hand, then you're less likely to suffer because of it. So that's an example of hearing the Dharma. Someone might say all those things. So then, to take the next step of engagement in the Dharma, it's be your job to reflect on that and question it. Maybe you have some doubts about it. Is this really, do you agree with this? Do you not agree with this? How do you agree with this? In what way is this useful for you to look at? And what is it? What's my relationship to my thinking? How do I think? What's my thinking like? Do I think in words? Do I think in images? Do I think more tactically through my body? Do I believe every thought that I have? Am I burdened by my thoughts? Do I feel oppressed by them? How is it that we relate to the kind of cognitive movements of the mind, the beliefs, the stories that the mind makes? I love my stories. That's what I like, and it's very entertaining, and I'd rather spend time in my story than anywhere else. Or I hate my stories. All my stories are cataclysmic. they predict the end of something, my universe. And I just can't get, they're tiring. I'm frightened by my own story-making mind. I love the Zen, Zen story of the artist, Chinese artist who was painting a very realistic dragon. And so he was there painting it away and very close up to the canvas. And then he stepped back to get a view of what he had made. And he just stepped back and looked at the dragon. It was so realistic it frightened him, so he ran away. So we make stories in our minds, and sometimes we get frightened by our own stories. So to look at that, and in fact, when we start reflecting on the teachings we've heard, it's not that interesting to agree or disagree. It's not that interesting to like it or not like it. I mean, you're welcome to do that, but some people specialize at that. There's a lost opportunity. And that is, what's most interesting is how can we engage whatever's being talked about in a way that's useful for us? Even if you disagree with someone and dislike what's being said, that's fine. But maybe there's something in there that's useful. Maybe 90% of the time in your life, 99% of the time, a teaching had no value whatsoever. But perhaps it's 1% of your life, one situation, and you're like, oh yeah, in that situation it might be true. And if it's not, so maybe I can kind of at least milk those teachings the best I can for that situation. So there's a way of engaging the Dharma where it's our job as in the reflective mode to figure out, how is this useful for me? And that can be very private. You don't have to tell the person that you disagree with him or her. You don't tell me, oh, that was terrible, Gil. You could if you want, but, I just mostly disagree with what you have to say. Because sometimes if we get into the mode, oh, I disagree with what you said, or I agree with what you said, it's very interesting because it's often tied in to our self-concept, building up ourselves or trying to prove ourselves or something. And so to not be involved in that, but see what's useful here so that I can become freer. What's useful here so that I could move on and mature and develop my life or be more helpful for my community. What's helpful in this kind of teaching? So in terms of thinking, what is your relationship to thinking? What have you learned about thinking in your life? What have you learned about what are the conditions that where you get caught in the world of stories and ideas? And what have you learned in your life about the conditions that support you from not being so caught, from stepping back from it? What have you learned there? What have been your experiences in your life as references points of what it's like to be caught in thought and what it's like not to be caught in thought? So I'll offer you an image that I have been meaningful for me, and I've taught this image because for me it's such a dramatic difference between being kind of in my world and my thinking and being and not being caught in that world, that I liken it to the difference between living in a two-dimensional world and a three-dimensional world. And so imagine going into, you know, imagine you always lived in a living room with a very big 52-inch television, state-of-the-art. And you had, you know, 500 or 1,000 channels to choose from. You know, and, you know, I suppose it'd be pretty entertaining. You know, you could watch all these shows. You get tired of one show, you go to another show. And it's, you know, big, and it's color, maybe it's even 3D by the time you get your 52-inch screen. And so you know, it's, you know, you're kind of living in the screen world. And that's all you know. And someone says, oh, there's another reality out there. No, there's nothing. And by the way, I have to find out what happens to my program. And then one day the electricity goes out, and you notice that there's this door to the outside world. So you think, since there's no electricity, I think I'll go out. And you go out, and you're surprised that there's a three-dimensional world outside. And there's, you feel the breeze against your cheek. You smell, the freshly cut lawn outside, and you feel the sun against your skin, and it kind of becomes alive and much more full than it could ever be by just kind of being with a television. Even though television is pretty infinite, what nowadays it could show you. It's a whole different category. It's a whole different kind of dimension almost to be out in the world. So living too much in our thoughts or preoccupying our thoughts is living a two-dimensional or maybe a one-dimensional life. And to be able to cultivate awareness practices, mindfulness practice to wake up, is as radical as going from two-dimensional to three-dimensional. It's just like suddenly the world becomes, not only the world, but also ourselves becomes much more richer and deeper and fuller. And then, you know, to reflect a little bit about, you know, what it's like to be in thoughts, but also what it's like to, what's your experience of directing with life directly? And what experiences have you had for meeting life directly and fully? And when do you feel most the immediacy, the poignancy of this moment now, most clearly, most powerfully, in such a way that it's deeply satisfying or enlivening for you? Are there times and moments for that? Does it have a value? And what's the difference between the value of that kind of experience versus the value of the kind of things that you pursue with your thinking mind, your active mind, your ideas? I've taught this often enough, but there was a time in my life a few years ago where I really enjoyed looking at old photographs. And they had to be really old so that all the people in the photograph were long dead. And what I liked about it was that, I'd go up and study their face, and particularly I liked to go look in their eyes. See, look at their eyes and expressions on their face. And even some photographs are 100 and even older years old. Sometimes they're very clear, and you can see the expression in their eyes. Sometimes you see a certain kind of delight, or sometimes a mischievousness, or sometimes sadness, weariness. Sometimes you can see different expressions. And, you know, it's an expression that was maybe momentary, that moment when the picture was taken. And the reason why I like looking at these pictures was I would see those faces and those the glimmer, that little kind of spark of consciousness and life in that person, and realize that was that person's time for living. That was that person's time, moment, to be conscious and aware. And this is my time. So rather than being lost in the world of the past, it actually would prompt me or stimulate me, wow, here. This is my moment. What is this magic moment like of being aware, present, alert, now like? This is the only time I have. This is my time. And how do we use this time? How do we engage this time? How do we enjoy this time? So that's kind of a reflection that can be done. So there's, you know, a wide range. And then there's a little more kind of classic Buddhist teachings that say that if you cling to something, you'll suffer. So then you can look, well, is this true for me? I have a lot of things I believe. Do I cling to them? How do I cling to them? How is clinging to them cause suffering? So all this has to do with contemplation, with reflection. It's a very important and rich part of life. And one of the reasons why it's very important is that a lot of our character, or a lot of our personality, or kind of our self structure, belongs to the world of thinking and ideas. And there's kind of these personality structures, or belief structures with which we organize ourselves with. And sometimes it's very important to engage in those and rearrange them and understand different ones, understand the limitations of them. And you need to kind of engage that world sometimes to understand it. And to engage in a kind of more direct meditation practice without reflection won't allow you to kind of really benefit from the full transformation that Dharma practice can entail. So, for example, there are certain structures that people have in their minds, belief structures, that can cause a lot of conflict and tension within themselves. And we have to kind of question some of these structures. So one of the structures, for example, is the structure of self and other, or autonomy and mutuality. If we fall on one side of the extreme of these, we end up having problems, or setting up a tension or a conflict between them. So this idea of being an individual in the United States, if we're hyper-individualistic, that itself, that structure, will cause, has a logic to it that makes sense, but that structure, that belief structure, will bring with it suffering. Because it doesn't make sense to be a complete individual, individualistic. You know, be your own person. To say, be your own person, and take it as an absolute extreme statement, makes as much sense as saying, speak your own language. You know, if you're the only person who speaks a language, what good is the language? You know, languages are meant for communication. And so, you know, you have to somehow be able to, and to be completely an individual, cut off from other people, the mutuality of human life is also to be cut off. But if we live totally into the mutual life, the way which we're interdependent on each other, then we kind of lose a certain kind of autonomy or mastery or ability to choose for ourselves. And so if we live too much in one or the other, or if we set up this kind of, it's too easy to set up a conflict between others and self, being independent, being cooperative. And some people live in this tension of this world. And we have messages, the society says you should be your own person, but then people say we're supposed to also kind of get along with people. And how do these work? Or there's conflicts in our minds, or structures in our minds, that say that you should not be a certain kind of way. You should, certain kind of expression. You should not be angry. And so then we say, that part of me cannot be there. And so then I have to deny that part of me. If we deny that part of me, that part sits and festers. If that festers, then it becomes stronger. And then the idea that I shouldn't be angry gets more to react against. And then there's this conflict that builds up inside of us that can really kind of be very detrimental to ourselves and cause a lot of suffering. So what I'm trying to say here is that we have these beliefs and belief structures that are very deeply connected to our sense of self, our sense of what it's like to be a person, what we should and shouldn't be, and how to be in society. And some of these structures need to be questioned and understood, and part of that process involves reflection and contemplation and questioning. The whole process of questioning in a deep way and reflection is greatly supported by the third way of engaging in the Dharma, and that is the approach of practice itself. And practice is very important because it's one of the most powerful ways of getting underneath or behind the thinking mind. If all we do is negotiate the world through thinking and rearrange the structures of our minds so we have better structures, then it's a little bit like rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. And you know, it's a nice thing to do, but maybe it's an important thing to do. It's important to do it to some degree, but you know, it's only going to take us so far. In order to really discover kind of the depths of our heart, the depth of possibility of freedom, the depths of our kind of the fullness of our kind of the life force that goes through us, the emotionality, the intentionality, and connections with people in the world, we have to find some way to drop into what is often called our direct experience. And a big part of what's called practice in Buddhism has to do with finding a way to engage in our direct experience, to meet it, to be it, to discover it. Independent, not independent, but in a way that doesn't get interfered by our thinking mind and our ideas. So the many different practices of Buddhism have many different functions, but I think ultimately they're really trying to encourage us to be fully in the present moment so we can see what's really going on here in a way that we can't if we're thinking about what's going on here. So how do we quiet the mind down enough, thinking mind down enough? How do we stabilize it enough so we can see in a much more direct way? So I'd like to suggest that there are three ways of doing this, of making this direct contact, or three aspects of it. Are you with me still? So recognizing what is happening as it's happening, the seeing part, seeing what's happening. The second is to feel what's happening. And the third is to soften around it, to soften into it, or to lighten up with it. So to see clearly, to feel it, because to see might be a little bit removed. To feel means you really have contact with it, and really there, present for it in a full way. To see makes you a little bit free, kind of steps back a little bit, being the observer, they say. But if you're only the observer and kind of detached, you don't really have the chance to really experience the fullness of what something is, and experiencing the fullness, the immediacy of it. So, for example, if I watch my breathing, that could be useful, but to watch it and to feel the experience of breathing puts us right more deeply into the experience to really, so seeing can be more full, more deeper. And the third thing, and it's to soften around it. So that means a lot of different things, but so I'm watching my breath, I'm feeling the experience of breathing, and then I notice that I'm trying too hard. I'm pushing perhaps, or there's some contraction, you know, and contracted around my belly as I breathe, or a little bit tight in my chest. Okay, so can I just soften a little bit, lighten up a little bit? It doesn't have to be dramatic. I like the word softening rather than relaxing, because relaxing is hard to do sometimes, but softening is make a little space around it. Be kind of more gentle about it. And so those three steps, to see, to feel, and then to soften. At some point, it doesn't make sense anymore to soften anymore, because you softened enough, you're relaxed enough. So then it becomes see and feel. At some point, you don't need to feel it anymore. And so you don't have to enter into the experience more fully because you're there for it. So then that falls away as a practice, and then you just have to see it. And then just to see clearly. And the heart of vipassana practice means to see clearly, to really see what's here. But this to see what's here, to feel it, and to soften, to relax, to allow what's here to be here, and then not to relax enough and soft enough that we're not in opposition to anything. We're not closed down to it. I found to be very, very helpful, because there's this almost like this innate wisdom or this natural way in which we can grow and develop if we allow ourselves to take in or experience what is here. A very important part of this Buddhist practice is learning to trust in some profound way that it's okay to experience our life as it is. If you can see and feel and soften, to relax around what's happening, not react to it, not be for it, not be against it, but to feel it and allow it to come in, then we can be changed by it, we'll be matured by it, or we'll allow the process that it is to unfold, with that natural unfolding kind of move through us. So very simple things like if I'm looking at my thinking, for example, I'm caught up in some kind of thought, preoccupied with something, so I might go and notice that I'm thinking, see that I'm thinking, and that's good. But then what does it feel like to be involved in that kind of thinking? Oh, it feels tight. I feel afraid when I have that kind of thought. I feel concerned about something. And so then what would it take to soften around that thought? Maybe what it takes is softening the eyes, or softening the shoulders, or softening some pressure or energy that's in the head. So it's not just simply letting go of thoughts, but it's feeling the whole thought construct, the whole thought phenomena, thinking phenomena, and then softening around it. If we don't soften or relax the pressure to think, then the pressure will remain even if we let go of the particular thoughts that we have, and we'll keep thinking some more. So, but then, say that I notice I'm thinking about something, and then I feel that experience, there might be some strong emotions connected to it. And so, for example, this weekend, I had, yesterday, I was kind of thinking, reviewing something that happened over and over again. And so I felt it. What's it like? And I felt, I felt a little bit sad about, so what's that sadness about? And then I realized, so then I kind of felt the sadness more fully. And as I felt the sadness more fully, I allowed myself to kind of drop into some deeper feeling of a wonderful loving connection I feel for another person. But if I'd stayed at the level of just thinking, I wouldn't have felt that deeper sense of connection. If I'd reacted to the sadness and said I shouldn't feel sad or recoiled from it, I wouldn't have kind of opened up and felt that kind of deeper heartfeltness. And from that place, then it was easier for me to go and make, kind of go back to the person and talk to the person that I need to. Let's talk about what happened, and I feel some regrets about what happened. So what I was trying to convey with that is the idea that by seeing and feeling and allowing, it allowed me to have some deeper, touch some deeper place of communication, of contact with someone that I couldn't if I'd stayed kind of more superficial. So we see, we feel, and we soften. This can be done to ourselves inwardly. And meditation practice is often seen as an inward kind of practice. And it can be done externally towards others. So inwardly, I want to give you an example from today that relates to thinking. Maybe some of you had this experience who meditate in the morning. I woke up around 5 o'clock. I was very comfortable in bed. And I had things to think about. First thing, boom, I was thinking about things. And it was kind of interesting to think about these things. Now, this is important to think about it. And I've meditated a lot in my life. I don't think I have to meditate. You know, I should lay here, it's comfortable. Maybe I'll think some more. It's very full, it's very rich, this thinking world. And the thinking world had this very wonderful, compelling quality to it, like this is the world. This is it. This is how you're going to solve the problems of your world, your life. This is where it's really at. This is, you know, it can feel, at least for me, I don't know if any for you, but the thinking world can feel more real than anything else. Maybe I won't meditate this morning. Because, you know, if I meditate, then I'll leave behind this rich world that seems so important. It is the world. And why should I leave that world? This is who I am, you know. This is this moment I'm my thinking. And should I give myself up and go and meditate? So, anyway, so I got up and meditated. Immediately, as I sat down to meditate, I said, wow, this is a relief. This is so much better. This is, you know, three-dimensional. This is really a rich world. This is so much more settled. And that world of thinking that was so compelling and so had such authority when I was laying there in bed and seemed so, you know, important, it lost its you know, it was, you know, it lost its magic, it lost its authority, it lost its, you know, it was seen kind of more for what it was. And I realized there's much more to being alive and being present than just laying in bed thinking, or just thinking and thinking, thinking. And I felt my life deepen and broaden, I didn't stop thinking entirely during some of that sitting, but it felt like a much deeper, much more satisfying way of being in the world than it would have been, even though in bed thinking, even though the thinking was pleasant. Make sense? So this kind of deeper connection, stop and feel and allow some deeper to happen. So that was very satisfying for me today. Yesterday with the sadness, it wasn't so satisfying immediately, but it had to do, you know, it allowed for something deeper. That's feeling that sadness, I trusted it, and it allowed for something deeper to happen there as well, something fuller and more meaningful, if I allowed myself to feel it, be present for it. So these are examples of being in the present moment for myself, feeling it directly and allowing that present moment experience to work me, to work through me. And then it can be done towards others, with others. And one of the wonderful aspects, I think, of life is our relationship to other people. And those relationships can deepen a lot, to be much more richer, if they don't happen only through the vehicle of our thinking. And probably most of you are thinking, well, I don't do that. Because I have, you know. But in fact, thinking is such a pervasive and powerful way in which we understand our world that it's really a veil or a filter through which we think we really make contact. And sometimes it can interfere with us really seeing someone else fully, and it can interfere with us seeing ourselves fully. Because in meeting someone else fully, we meet ourselves. So I was reminded of a couple of examples that I thought were quite powerful. One is there's a Zen teacher in San Francisco named Blanche Hartman, who has come and taught here a few times. Beautiful woman, and she recounts an event in her life that propelled her into the world of Buddhist practice. This event was so significant for her, she realized there is another way, there's another possible way of living in this world, kind of another almost like reality, and I have to kind of find out how to do this, and she found Zen. It was 1968, I think, and she was a mother, I think four kids, and I think she had a child who went to San Francisco State. So she was in her late 40s, I think. And there were, back in those days, there were all these college protests, demonstrations against the Vietnam War and other things going on. And some of these were quite violent. San Francisco State, the police roughed up demonstrators, and there was, you know, beat them up and things. And so that was part of what was going on. And so there was a call that went out asking for parents or community members to come and kind of help stand between the riot police and the students as a way of, you know, maintaining the peace. So she did. She went. And there she was between these two groups. And she had a very antagonistic idea about police. And a lot of people didn't. A lot of the young people, people in the 60s. Maybe unfortunately, but the police was like the bad other. And there she was, sandwiched between protesters and the police. These riot police, I don't know exactly how they came into contact with each other, but they were, at one point she was directly facing one of the police officers. And they looked each other in the eye. And something happened in looking him directly in the eye that she was changed forever. And she stopped being an activist. She's still a little bit of that. She still continued in various ways, but the kind of active, I guess, activist she was, she stopped. So what was it that happened? What did she see? What happened when she looked the police officer directly in the eye, when they saw each other? What is it that what kind of contact can you have with someone else and somehow be changed by that direct and immediate fullness of meeting a complete stranger? What do you see in someone else's eyes who's a stranger? What can you see when you drop your thoughts, your idea that there's another out there, they're the bad person? You see the fullness of the person if you see, if you feel, and if you soften, if you relax and let someone else come in. She said her sense of identity of who she was kind of went away. The sense of identity, she felt close identity or mutuality with the officer in a way that she'd never experienced before with anyone. Changed her life. So then, I think it was yesterday, I read in the current issue of Tricycle, there's a story about Vinny Ferraro. Vinny has come and taught here at IMC also. He's a Dharma punk Dharma teacher. Punk Dharma teacher with all the tattoos and everything. Tough guy. You know, they say in the magazine article that he sounds like the, I guess, Sopranos. Is that like a mafia people? I've never seen it, but right. So like they said, Sopranos, like kind of like mafia. He called me once in my house. I wasn't home, and my wife took the phone and said, "This guy called you. You know, he sounds like mafia. he wants to talk to you." And but I didn't call him back right away. So he called back and talked to my wife, and my wife said, "I think you better call this guy." And anyway, so he's a wonderful man. He does wonderful Dharma work. So there's an article about him in the Tricycle, and a little bit of his life story. And he grew up in gangs, in a poor neighborhood, and very violent. He ran in a gang, and he was a violent gang member. And when he was 15, his gang came across a homeless man in their turf, in their hood, or whatever. And so they started beating him up. And as he was doing this, the homeless man said, looked right towards Vinny and said, "Help me, help me." And Vinny said, "Why should I help you?" And the man said, "When I look into your eyes, I see more compassion there than in any woman I've ever seen, ever known. There's more compassion in your eyes than any woman I've ever seen and known." That was the end of the beating. And that changed Vinny's life. he'd never known that part of himself. He had never known his feelings in that kind of deep way. He was reflected and seen. Something was seen. What do you see when you look into someone else's eyes? What do people see in you? And what is it? What would it mean to really see someone else? To feel in that seeing, to feel yourself, to feel the other, to really feel, and then to relax and to soften. Who would you encounter? I've done this with complete strangers and had a deeper, intense, loving, fuller connection with a stranger in 5 minutes than I've had with friends I've known for years. And it can happen so quickly. And then how are we changed? How does that influence us? So this idea of the Dharma works through us, that we're being worked. We're allowing something to affect us. If we think we're in charge, then we can't really allow this deeper movement to happen. So to really see what's here, and then to feel what's here, to allow the feeling to be here, and then to soften, to relax. And relaxing allows the feeling to be more full, or allows something to kind of move through us or unfold. And so we enter into the direct experience, to see it and to allow this deeper unfolding, to discover a world of trust where we can let something go through us rather than us being in charge. So to engage in the Dharma, to learn the Dharma, to study it, to reflect on it and think about it, perhaps with the support and help of your friends who you can enter into conversations, and what do you think of that? And then to practice it. And to practice it is to enter into your direct experience and leave the Dharma behind. So, thank you. And may you engage the Dharma happily.